Well, now it has a name. They're calling it the response gap. How long would it take to respond to an oil spill in Arctic Ocean conditions? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we continue our discussion of issues raised by the problems Shell's having in its exploration program. Your calls have been making this show. Our statewide phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage, 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. What is the state of our response capability and how do we get to where it needs to be? Is once again the subject on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Once again, the subject, what's the state of our response capability and how do we get it to where it needs to be for dealing with oil exploration in the Arctic Ocean? Now, Alaskans are far from united on this very question, and that's one of the reasons why we need to be talking about it a lot. Well, the latest on the offshore drilling rig, the Kulik, is that it's in Kaluta Bay. It's going to stay there while the crab fishery goes on around it, and they're trying to make it ready for the long tow to Seattle. Shell's other drill ship, the Noble Discoverer, remains in Seward. It's been reported that there's a criminal investigation going on of the propulsion, safety, and explosion problems it has had. That's from a source. I wouldn't know if that's confirmed. And, of course, the FBI and so forth would not confirm it. And to the south, Shell's spill response barge, the Arctic Challenger, never got itself up to seaworthiness, and its test of the containment dome went so badly, the containment bell funnel went so badly that the device may be irreparably damaged. This limited Shell to top drilling this past year, and it is far from certain that the company can even muster an adequate fleet to do any drilling at all this year. Last week, we heard Shell spokesman Curtis Smith say the company knows its performance has been unacceptable, but we're all still learning. ConocoPhillips, State Oil, and Repsol wait in the wings to bring their own fleets up to the Chukchi. Still learning. The Coast Guard continues to try to bring a presence to the north, talking about ice-fitted buoy tenders and aircraft. Prospects for a deepwater port somewhere closer than Dutch Harbor remain under study. Still learning. So, what if there's a spill? What about the weather forecasting capability? Response equipment? Communication? Dispersants, are they on hand? Would they even work if they were used? Is that the way to go? Burning. Do we even know what would happen? Are we able to track plumes? Do we know what kind of plumes, how far they would travel, and so forth? Last fall, the Arctic Research Commission put out a whole list of what needs to be researched and what might be done to better prepare for dealing with oil spills in Arctic waters. And I spoke with the Commission's Deputy Director, Cheryl Rosa, about it. And I challenged her by saying I didn't really see where much had changed about oil spill response technology between the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska in 1989 and the Deepwater Horizon spill of 2010.
You know, there's a general perception that there hasn't been any work done in the Arctic. And one of the things that this publication shows is that there has been work done. Are we done? Are we finished with our research? Absolutely not. There certainly is a lot more that needs to be done. And the Arctic obviously is quite a bit different than the Gulf. And there are going to be certain things that can be drawn out of the lessons learned from the Deepwater Horizon. However, it's important to note that there is quite a bit of difference. Obviously, it's an Arctic climate. There's much, much reduced infrastructure in the area. Even something just as basic as communications, not having good internet in places like Wainwright, Point Lay, all of a sudden you have hundreds of workers descend upon a small village, all with extremely high info input needs. There's certain ways to circumvent it using satellite technology, but the reality is in a lot of ways, especially with the logistics of local area capacity, you're stuck with what you're stuck with. And right now, none of these small communities are prepared to take the onslaught of what would be required in the case of a response, large-scale response, especially not one similar to the Deepwater Horizon type spill. And that's why, you know, prevention is so incredibly important and, you know, as has been discussed by many in the past. But you certainly hope for the best but be prepared for the worst, and that's what I think a lot of this research is basically trying to get people to make the most informed decisions they can possibly make about oil spill development, what's being done, and the best way to respond if something bad was to happen.
One thing that's brought up, and it's been brought up before, is that the OPNI capped the oil spill liability trust fund. And basically the commission suggests that it's time to take that cap off and use that money to start paying NOAA to take more of a lead role.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the money that has been spent on oil spill research in general, it's amazing how little has actually been spent right up until Deepwater Horizon. But of that money that was spent, I think that the number was somewhere like $164 million, if I remember correctly. Only a fraction of that is Arctic-related issues and research. We've got an 11-year period of around the year 2000, including right up to 2010, right up through the Deepwater Horizon incident, with about $164 million spent on oil spill research. And that includes everything. That's not just Arctic-specific. And really, for that amount of time, that's pretty. It's a pretty low amount. And I'd venture to say a very small fraction of that is Arctic-related. And That needs to change if development is going to happen here. You know, we've got this exploratory effort, and with all intentions of eventually developing these fields, you know, we certainly need to have our research expenditures match the interest that's going on in the region in order to protect the region.
And that was Cheryl Rosa, the Deputy Director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, about their most recent report, Oil Spills in Arctic Waters. And this follows on earlier things going all the way back to about 2004. They've been on this. And when you actually, you know, look at the details and the nuts and bolts, what we don't know is huge and humbling. What we don't know is vast. So anyway, that's once again our subject here on Talk of Alaska. What's the state of our response capability? How do we get it to where it needs to be? And what should be the priorities that we as Alaskans should have? Joining us in this discussion for you to talk with here at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org, is Mark Myers. He's Vice Chancellor for Research, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and joined us by telephone. Mark, welcome to Talk of Alaska, and it's great to have you on the show. How long have you been Vice Chancellor up there now?
Hi, Steve, for a little over 2 years.
And then before that, you were running the U.S. Geological Survey, and before that you were, man, I don't even know, you were kind of a consultant, and you were in the oil industry for a while.
Right, in the oil industry for a while. When I first came up to Alaska, I actually sat on some of the big offshore wells in the early 80s. I was Director of Oil and Gas for the state of Alaska for 5 years. And state geologist as well.
So obviously, this is stuff you've thought about a whole lot, and so it's great to have you on the program. And I'm just going to start the conversation going and see where the calls go. But basically, I thought I'd give you a chance to talk about what kind of research the university has been able to muster up the funding to do. I mean, I know for instance, the oceanography is an ongoing thing. It's expensive. You got to have the equipment out there, you got to put the people out in the field, but it's getting a little easier to do now because we have much better communications. We do remote sensing and use the buoys that send signals, and we got those gliders, underwater gliders and things now. So it's getting a little better, but still quite a lot really, that the university has been involved with in this down through the years. I thought maybe you'd just get a little sketch.
Okay, well, thanks, Steve. Yeah, the university has been doing a lot of varied research on a lot of the fundamental issues of how the Arctic ecosystem functions and how with the warming in the north and the changes in sea ice and permafrost and cryosphere effects, it's affecting those ecosystems. In understanding that, you end up looking at some very specific important questions that also affect concerns with an Arctic oil spill, whether it be from a ship, whether it be from oil and gas exploration or from production. And so some of those key things are what's happening, what's the behavior and the changes of behavior in the sea ice. Again, one of the unique characteristics of the Arctic, of course, is it freezes over every year and access, and it's dark and very cold and very hard to access, even if you had the ports and infrastructure. You're operating in severe conditions. Secondly, cleaning up oil and ice is and under ice is a very different task than cleaning up in open water. The Arctic ecosystem is very different than the systems in the Gulf of Mexico or even in the Gulf of Alaska or Prince William Sound. So we have to understand the tolerance of organisms to oil, how much oil is naturally in the system, how fast it biodegrades, then this the physical behavior of oil mixing with ice. It's a very complex relationship when new ice forms and its relations with ice. And then finally, you have to track the movement of oil in ice. You have to understand the movement of ice itself at a fairly fine scale. And as you mentioned, in a lot of cases, we don't have the resolution of data necessary that we have. We don't have the amount of radar. We don't have the full gamut of satellite coverage. And, of course, during much of the year, it's very dark, so optical systems don't work, so you rely heavily on radar. Cloud cover make a big difference. So there are a lot of specializations. And also, because it's remote and because we have the severe conditions, putting people into that environment to do the observational work is very difficult to do. And, in fact, we're limited by the weather conditions, so using remote systems. And I think that's one of the breakthroughs where the university really has a strong leadership role is that it's work with unmanned aerial systems that can carry high-resolution devices to image all the way from radar to broadband hyperspectral instruments to laser LIDAR systems to samplers to actually sample an oil plume and get atmospheric samples all remotely by a vehicle that can sit up like 21 hours at a time and can be launched without an airfield. Unmanned submarine gliders that can actually, we're working to instrument them to work under the ice. So we can send unmanned submarines for weeks at a time out in that environment, powered primarily by buoyancy differences. They pop up to the surface, report their data, and then go back down. So ways to be able to get a three-dimensional view of the environment even within and under ice. We also are trying to build better oil ice trajectory models and integrate oil in that ice. For instance, the surface currents do one thing, but what are the currents doing under the ice? I mean, there's assumptions made, but we don't really understand it. And then finally, looking at the ecosystem itself, the habitats, understanding how that ecosystem functions, where are the vulnerabilities, where are the most sensitive areas, and then how do organisms respond to oil? How fast does oil biodegrade? How does it bioaccumulate in species? What are the critical seasons where you're most concerned about migratory marine mammals, for example, or seabirds being affected and how they're affected? So a whole gamut of research is actually being done at the university. Yeah. One of our goals is to fill some of those gaps.
Mark Myers is with us, Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And, one thing I wanted to bring up was synthetic aperture radar remote sensing. It's my understanding that UAF is a repository for that information, but it's also my understanding that they're not flying a whole lot of SAR anymore for some reason.
Well, the U.S. does not have an unclassified radar satellite, and so we rely heavily on Canadian, European, and historically on Japanese satellites. So UAF has a series of antenna dishes that download the data. So the satellites that observe the Arctic fly in a polar orbit, so we're in a position where we are really one of the first people to be able to receive that data. We have unique, very, not 100% unique, but very rapid response and very rapidly developed products to manage like sea ice. So, for instance, the Canadian Ice Service uses our derived products to determine ice and ice movement. And then, of course, synthetic aperture radar has an advantage, spaceborne systems particularly, of having a relatively rapid repeat cycle over a broad area.
Yeah, we can also see through the clouds is always important, too.
But its resolution isn't perfect, and when you get oil in ice issues, you have a hard time discerning the oil from the ice. So that's one of the things we've learned. The Gulf of Mexico, pretty effective at deterring oil in open water because of the difference of reflectivity. But when you get in ice conditions and ice water conditions, it in itself is good, but not sufficient to be able to actually discern oil in certain conditions. So we know we need to use a combination of satellites, imagery satellites when we have them, wide band spectral satellites, hyperspectral capacity. No, most of that's airborne flown to date. But those sorts of instruments have real high value in terms of combining with synthetic aperture radar to be able to look at a broader range of derivative products that can help you discern that oil from the water and the ice.
Well, I'll give you one. The closer you get to this stuff, the bigger it gets. And it's damn big. As an example, one thing that I try and track is the endangered species out there, the ice-dependent species out over Hannah Shoal and in that area in the Chukchi. And so this past year, I saw the map showing that there wasn't any ice there, and yet I had accounts from people in the field saying, no, the walrus is still there. They're sitting on the ice. There is ice. So I got in touch with one of your faculty members, Hayo Eichen. And so what in the world is going on? Why is there ice still down in Hannah Shoal and we can't see it? And he says, well, yeah, actually, I just flew over that ice. He said, I think it broke off someplace up in northern Canada, and there's quite a bit of it, and it's some big, fat, multi-year ice, and it's going to sit around for a while. It doesn't just go away, but it will go away. But it ended up that the walrus had some stuff to sit on there despite the record withdrawal of sea ice. And so this is totally not what we expected at all, and we're just knowing it because, we're learning a little bit more about what we're seeing and because somebody happened to go out there and see it. And then another researcher at the University of Manitoba said, yeah, what we had was we had this what we call an ice island, which was an enormous hunk of ice that doesn't even show up in remote sensing because it's dark in color, and it's very solid ice. It takes a long time to go away, and it has it's so large and has such huge momentum that they actually have to move everything out of the way because it's going to push anything in front of it away. And I didn't know about that, and nobody, it turns out, knows the frequency of these things or anything like that, or how much that might have changed now that more stuff is breaking off from northern Canada. And it goes on and on and on. You can look at like currents and what's going on with what would be the path or trajectory of oil very much depends on where it popped out and how, where the currents would take it and whether it would go over towards Russia or up along Barrow and on and on and on. So we can easily go through details for an hour on this program, actually the remaining 40 minutes of it, but we got a whole lot of Alaskans calling in, Mark, and I want to thank you for being with us here as we can kind of start running through these. You ready?
You're ready.
All right. We'll start with Renee, who calls from Beyond Esther. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Renee.
Good morning. I think it's important when we're doing business with anyone, personally, as a state, whoever, to examine the character and the history. How have they shown themselves to be? And in this regard, we can go back to the Exxon Valdez when their communication systems went on automated and they were reel-to-reel taping everything that went on. And we had the call from their representative in Valdez to Anchorage Home Office at that time. And the guy in Anchorage is saying, well, are the skimmers out there? You know, and the guy in Valdez says, no, they aren't working. And the guy in Anchorage says, get them out there. The press is there. I don't care if they're working or not, with a certain amount of expletives in there. It was all about the show. Then we see the deep water issues. We see BP's history of absence of maintenance and the negligence-based spills that occurred up north. When all of this stuff gets wrapped up, we add in AOGA's nonsense claims about being the highest taxed in North America when, in fact, we're not. We see a repeated history of dishonesty in business and negligence resulting in environmental and economic impact. I guess the bottom line for me, considering what would happen in my mind, and I'm not a pro at this, but you get 6 feet of broken sea ice and a spill, you may be able to say, yeah, there is or isn't oil there. What are you going to do about it effectively in 6 foot of broken sea ice, other than maybe the people in charge do what the, you know, for the corporation, do what they've historically done, which is to deny that it's there and try and distance themselves from liability? My question is, when somebody has this kind of a history, why are we doing business with them at all?
Okay. Thanks, Renee. And I don't know, anybody's got a good answer for that. I do think that, you know, as time goes on, I mean, there is, you would have to characterize it kind of as a rush to the Arctic. And whether it's Russians or, you know, somebody's going to be drilling there quite soon, whether it's Alaska Arctic, Canada Arctic, you know, Norwegian Arctic, Greenland Arctic. Sounds like we lost Renee. Yes, Mark, I am thinking that somebody's going to be doing it anyway. We're going to have to learn what this technology is at some point. And I don't know how you decide what's, you know, what's the lesser evil, which company you want to work with and like that. I just don't know.
Yeah, Steve, if I could just make a comment, there's really three sorts of challenges that we face with an oil spill in the Arctic. And only two of those really have to deal with oil and gas. The third is marine shipping. So as we see the decrease in seasonal sea ice, we're seeing much more traffic coming to the Northern Sea Route. We're seeing, again, cruise ships coming up to do Arctic tourism. We're seeing a lot more scientific research vessels up there. That response, again, of a ship having an accident, if it's not an industry ship, is not the industry's responsibility. So there is an issue of how do we respond to a spill of shipborne oil, either let's just pick a product tanker that's coming up to refuel a community, or a ship that's coming down from a newly developed mine, or a Russian oil tanker that's transiting the Bering Straits. So we have a fundamental issue with marine shipping that's different than Open 90. It's under a whole different standards. It may be an internationally flagged vessel. It may not be a U.S. vessel. It may not be reporting. It may be a cruise ship. So there's one issue with shipping that's really acute now, because we're seeing this incredible increase in transit of ships and in ships in activity in the Arctic. And, of course, our Bering Straits and north are the gateway up through that system. And possibly in the longer bit, we might see the Northwest Passage itself open. In the short term, we might see development on the Canadian side of mines that are going to be seasonally transiting the areas, and ice-strengthened ships moving cargo through. The second is the oil exploration piece of it, which is going to be done in open ice seasons. But the third is if they're successful in exploration, the development. In the development scenario, you have undersea subsea pipelines, you have year-round operations going on, so the equipment that's up there in the summer, is most of that's going to be moved out because of the ice-free conditions. So you have three different scenarios. You know, we're addressing the oil and gas exploration development piece, but the challenge of an oil spill in the Arctic and historically around the world is significant with shipping, and we're not really addressing that issue. The Coast Guard is looking at it, as are other agencies, but it's a real big challenge in addition to the oil and gas exploration and development.
Yeah, the recommendation from USARC is we really need to get the permits or whatever's necessary, get the hurdles out of the way, and do some testing on in-situ burning with the actual product that might actually have to be burned, because we really have no idea right now.
There have been some in-situ burns, particularly offshore Norway area, and they've actually been fairly successful. One difference in the Arctic, in certain circumstances, where you have some ice and leads generally, it's fairly easy to burn the oil in the leads. Dispersants have to be used in a critical time where the volatiles are still within the oil. In the Arctic, because of the colder for temperature, that window is a little longer. So in-situ burning appears on these tests, these actual open burning tests they've done with actual releases of oil, experimental releases of oil, in different countries. Canada did some, I believe, in the late 70s, have actually been fairly successful. But you have to remember, even with in-situ burning or with mechanical cleanup, you're only getting a relatively small percentage of the oil.
And another one that's brought up by the commission is using herding substances. For instance, you might have a bunch of crude is trapped in a lead, and you could actually keep it from traveling in one direction or another on the lead by having some kind of herding agent there that would keep it from going that direction, dam it off, as it were. I had never thought of that, but by golly, it makes sense. And there must be all sorts of other things that are coming along.
Well, herders also provide, for in-situ burning to work, the oil has to be a certain thickness. Once it smears out to really thin, it doesn't work effectively. So herders allow you to push and maintain a critical thickness of oil film on the water so it can actually burn. So they can limit where the oil spreads, but they're also really valuable in maintaining an in-situ burning situation if you go on that route. And again, they have experimentally, on relatively small scales, been shown to be fairly effective on moving oil.
All right, Mark. All right, thank you, Mark Myers, joining us by telephone, University of Alaska Vice Chancellor for Research, UAF. Tom joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Hello there, Steve, and to your guest. Reference all this talk about capturing spilled oil. Let's try and look at events before then, in other words, the prevention. With a safety management system, one would look at events that lead to incidents. And it's been categorized in aviation industry anyway that approximately 300 incidents are precursor to an accident. So if we look at the activities of Shell here in recent time, we've had the dragging of the anchor at Dutch Harbor and, you know, all these various other things down by Bellingham, you know, with the bell to capture the spilled oil that was damaged even in a sea trial in I guess, Puget Sound. And of course, the latest with the Kulik and so on, a four-engine tug loses all power. How can that be?
Well, we talked about that last week. Yeah, and let's not forget the explosion in the engine.
Oh, well, see, I didn't even know that. But it goes on, and I could tell you that I remember last summer watching them fly their SPHI helicopters with no de-icing out to their rig there in the Boeing, the Beaufort Sea, and mainly operating in VFR conditions, 1,000 feet, 3 miles. Well, that's pretty rare in the summertime, so you need something that can handle more adverse weather. And so anyway, I'm just wondering what they're doing to look at all of these human factors. I mean, just dragging anchor when you're in a safe harbor, I mean, that is analogous to the surgeon removing the wrong kidney. So I'm looking at, as I understand, CH2M Hill had a number of accidents involved of people backing up vehicles. So now they've put in a policy, at least for a time period, where drivers have to call their supervisor every time they're going to back up. And he says, is it clear? How far is it clear? Can you see? Have you walked around? And it's a pain in the butt. On the other hand, it's really raising the awareness. It's part of a policy to raise awareness. And presumably they'll get to something a little more reasonable after that. But the point is, some companies are being more proactive and analyzing in a systemic way you know, what's causing these and getting feedback and trying to mitigate the risk based on probability and severity. So that's my main issue there, rather than trying to capture the oil when it's gone. I mean, that needs to be looked at as well. But a lot of these things are pretty basic about human factors.
That is a great observation. And, you know, we now have a federal regulatory office, the BSEA, that's supposed to be doing that. I will have to say they have a very small presence so far in Alaska. They're almost entirely down at the Gulf of Mexico. But
right. So anyway, as a resident, I'd be interested in knowing about what kind of systems do they have to look at their incidents, and do they track them in a taproot analysis sort of way, looking for, you know, all of these supplementary systemic causes for why there's this breakdown in, you know, people not following procedures or not having the right kind of equipment or not planning, you know, for adverse conditions and so on.
Yeah, Tom, that's fantastic. It's great stuff to think about. Mark Myers, do you have any thoughts on that, building a safety culture and autopsying events so that you actually get the lessons learned?
Yeah, I think the caller makes a great series of points, and clearly the issue needs to have multiple points of redundancy when you're operating in remote severe environments, and that starts with the culture of safety. The safety systems are usually on the rigs. For instance, that's why a blowout preventer is a last ditch. It should never get to the blowout preventer. The drilling mud, all the issues that went into the Macondo spill is a classic case where there was a layered defense that's designed to be used, but it was circumvented by a series of what appear to be decisions made by people. And so there was a failure of safety culture that was clear, and that's come out with the multiple reports, and it's pretty straightforward. So that culture has to be continually reinforced, and often when it fails because of someone's more concerned with the schedule or the budget than they are with the safety culture. So I think it's not only the company has to have it on the books, but they have to practice it and they have to value it above the short-term profitability. They have to make sure that safety is the highest priority, and that's conveyed all the way from their top management all the way down to that roustabout working on the rig, and they understand that. So embedding that culture. On the reinforcement side, again, the agencies aren't funded all that well when you look at Boehm and Bessie. They clearly could use more funding. Another systemic problem, in my opinion, is you really need experienced hands and experts in these organizations that have operational experience. And so you need to have a pay structure that's adequate to retain those folks within the regulatory community that really understand the issues and really have the ability to enforce the standards. So it's a combination of, I think, oversight, enforcement, structural development in the agencies, but also a safety culture that's paramount in the companies and an insistence on that. And I can't speak again to Shell or to BP's, but you know the management studies that will come out after these events hopefully will be a strong warning that things have gone wrong and we really need to review the systemic reasons as to why companies that have good technology and really skilled people can allow these sorts of things to happen.
Our subject is what do we need to be looking at as Alaskans about what should be in place to deal with situations as they go to explore for oil and gas in the Arctic Ocean. And remember, it's all still just exploration, but the site, the location where they're doing it indicates they really think there's quite a bit there. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology. PROVImaging.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Well, we're all uncomfortable about the prospects of oil and gas drilling in the outer continental shelf of the Arctic Ocean. We're all uncomfortable. The question is, what would make us more comfortable? And that's the subject today on Talk of Alaska once again, especially in view of the mishaps that Shell has experienced as they explore the frontier area of the Chukchi Sea and even into the Beaufort Sea. Mark Myers, Vice Chancellor of Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, is with us by phone. And a great, great batch of calls coming in. Robert joins the program from Sitka. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Robert.
Thank you. I think this is a great topic. I guess the only point that I would make is that accidents are going to happen. So anything that you can do in terms of understanding currents and flow and ice movement and then how to remove the waste once there is excellent. But the fundamental issue, I think, in all this is one of accidents are going to happen, and you're going to have to come up with a way to contain the spills when they do occur. So that should be a primary focus. And having assets on a piece of paper isn't good enough, as we continually see both in the Gulf of Mexico and also in an environment like the Arctic, where we can expect that things are going to be even more difficult in terms of your ability to respond and actually maintain those assets in some sort of form that they can respond quickly. And it also sounds like there's some serious jurisdictional issues in terms of who gets to call what shots where. And I think that's an organizational problem. But what the basic thing that I see right now is that the resources aren't there. We can talk about safety quite a bit, and it is emphasized. I have worked on the North Slope, and I realize that everybody that I've run into up there is very concerned about this, and they're concerned about the environment. So it's not a situation where people are cavalier. But this point can't be underestimated enough, is that oil is a primary energy concern of this country, and if there's oil, they're going to drill for it and they're going to produce it. And that's a fact of life. And so what we have to do is figure out how we can handle these mishaps when they happen. And the problem is, like the other caller just pointed out, there's a Pareto's law here. And so you have a lot of little incidents that happen first, and the severe accidents have an extremely low probability. But when they occur, they have very severe ramifications. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
All right, Robert, thank you very much. I think jurisdictionally, you know, we are talking mostly Coast Guard here, but BOEM and BSEE, I'm already running into situations where BSEE says, that's BOEM, and BOEM saying, oh, that's BSEE. that's not promising. And, you know, they don't have enough resources. I don't think there's any question about it. And until we actually know where we can base and stockpile equipment, until those places are actually located, until those studies are done, I think we are in grave peril. And I think, Mark Myers, you'd probably agree with me on that.
Well, certainly, it all depends on the scale of the incident and how quickly it's contained. It's paramount, in my opinion, that this capping device that Shell has works, because we know if, in the Gulf of Mexico case, at least it worked. On the Alaska area, we're drilling at a depth of the Berger prospects about 149 feet, and the previous wells in the Chukchi were drilled between 141 and 152 feet, so it's 157 feet. So it's relatively shallow, relatively low pressure, which is a good thing. And the same in the Beaufort, where they were drilling, where they previously drilled in the Kublin area, about 100 feet, 90 to 100, 116 feet of water.
Holy mackerel, so, you can dive in that.
Exactly, which again, if you ought to be able to develop a capping containment system that's going to be effective in that environment. So getting that capping system to contain, again, if the multiple systems prior to that, you know, if the drilling mud, if the casing systems, if the blowout preventer all fail, as they did in Macondo for various reasons, they pulled the drilling mud out of the hole when they shouldn't have. Obviously, the cement job wasn't good on the well. Series of mistakes that were made that were not rectified. So the multiple tiers broke. Then a capping device is really a next go. So if you can maintain that flow at a minimum amount of discharge, you can do it with much less infrastructure. Additionally, we do have assets on the slope with Alaska Clean Seas that sit there at Prudhoe Bay. It's designed for the existing infrastructure, but there's a sizable amount of equipment and capacity there if it can get out and be used, if the agreements are such that they can share. One of the challenges in the legalist environment is if I share my equipment with you, then I'm more vulnerable at my site. So how do we work the liability issues between sites? And then finally, if the spill is large enough and it's an uncontained flow for a long period of time and they can't stop the flow in the well, and they can't get a relief well drilled in that first season, that means a significant period of flow, in which case you're probably not going to be able to clean up much of that oil. It's going to get under the ice. It's going to be moved by currents significant distances. So then you're really looking at response to critical environments, looking at natural biodegradation of the system, and you're sort of along for the ride in many cases because of the current capacity.
Well, now here's a geology question. How realistic is this relief well thing? You know, they're saying, for instance, like, well, Shell has to have two rigs. It's got the one rig, and then if there were a spill and they needed to do a relief well, they need to have a second rig. And, of course, this is going to be coming up this year, I would expect. But, I mean, you know, do you think our seismic and so forth is such that you actually understand the geology well enough that a relief well would be, the prospects of it would be fairly good, that it would be successful?
I actually think, well, there's several questions. So first of all, five wells have been drilled in the Chukchi Sea. Where they're drilling their first exploration wells, Alberta, they're delineating a previous discovery that found a significant, about 14 trillion cubic feet of gas. They're drilling down dip to see if there's an oil lake and how big it is. So they have penetrated the geology of that prospect, and I think they understand it well. They understand the pressures. They understand the reservoir. And the other important piece is that you really, having drilled through it, you probably have and really good seismic data, you have a pretty good representation of the shallow hazards. So the hazards don't just come from the reservoir itself. They often, if you see the well incidences, they occur encountering a shallow pocket of gas at higher pressure than expected. Gas hydrates that are in solid form that get warmed up by the drilling and then come out before you're prepared for them. So there's a fair amount of good seismic data to be able to predict those sorts of occurrences. And having drilled through it, they're less likely. But there's still a risk there with the shell. That said, that's not going to spill a lot of oil. It's going to release gas. It may catch the rig on fire in a worst-case scenario. But it's not going to discharge a lot of oil. When you hit the main reservoir bearing interval, since they've already drilled through there, it's possible to be surprised, but it's much less likely. So your seismic data is now calibrated with the first well that was drilled through there. So you have a pretty darn good picture on that particular prospect. We know it's not overpressured, which is a significant thing with Macondo, very high pressures. So the flow rates coming out of the formation are going to be most likely, based on the geology they've already drilled, significantly less at a rate, but still a significant amount of oil. It could be easily in the thousands of barrels a day. So the important thing is to get it contained. With the drilling piece of it, they back off in the season. The question is, when are they required to stop drilling? So there needs to be enough time from if they were to have the accident where they determine they can't cap it, they need the relief well in there, that they're able to pick up the other rig, which is drilling on the location, move it on the location, and be able to drill the relief well before the ice season sets in. And so that limit, that date where you must stop drilling, is a critical date that has to be managed in the regulatory environment and obviously agreed to by the companies and enforced. So as long as there's enough time, I believe, yes, they can be very successful drilling a relief well. You're in relatively shallow water. The geology is relatively well understood. And relief well technology, steering technology is very good. So I'm pretty comfortable as long as you have enough time left before they have to pull the rigs out, you can successfully complete a relief well.
Wow. Ask a geologist, and the answer shall be bestowed upon you. Thank you, Mark Myers. Let's go to Dave, joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk Alaska, Dave.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Stephen. Good morning, Mr. Myers. I guess I'm coming from a couple perspectives here, the first of which is having worked up there with three different companies offshore in support work for this, and having seen not only the power of that ice when it cuts loose and moves, I mean, it's just an awesome, terrible thing that no man-made thing can stand up against. I've seen it and watched it for days on end when it blows in the fall. And we had the seismic ships up there having to get the heck out of the way, as we did. We had to run behind the barrier islands when this stuff started moving. And something which is common to all of the oil companies up there, and I've gone through their training, and it is just harsh, and it is, I mean, just mind-numbing what they try to inculcate in your work ethics up there and how to do it. class after class after class before even going up there. But it always comes down to some decision made in Houston or wherever that sets this chain of events rolling. And that's the big factor, I think, that you know, no matter how hard you try to make this happen, there's always an operational decision that occurs in a quick moment. And here you are. You've got this terrible scenario underway and very little means with which to deal with it. And I guess I'll get off with the last thing, the 800-pound gorilla that we are all pretending isn't there. Our climate is warming up. We're having huge issues ahead of us. We've got open water and larger waves up there than we've ever seen because there's such a huge fetch because there's no ice to break it up. And yet we continue to just keep bowling ahead like it's not going to affect us. Thank you.
All right, Dave. Yeah, some voice of experience there, too. But, yeah, I'm not sure how to really even deconstruct that. It kind of stands on its own. It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about what do we need to get in place, what would make us feel more comfortable about oil and gas exploration off the Arctic coast. Our guest is Mark Myers, Vice Chancellor for Research, University of Alaska Fairbanks, and of course you, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Got some emails waiting here, but I think I'll take this one up with you, Mark Myers. Protecting the wellhead during the winter after the rig has left and you've got your wellhead there, you got a blowout preventer, you've got they're talking about recessing the blowout preventers in some way so that they wouldn't get scraped by the passing ice in these shallow waters. What do you think?
Absolutely critical. So one of the big questions is at what depths do you get ice scoured? And it's a combination of the behavior of the ice. Again, these large chunks that break off and then ground, as you mentioned, offshore Barrow, where you had a very large piece coming and ground. We have to really understand those depths, and absolutely have to bury. You have to bury the blowout preventer to be safe underneath at the water depths we're talking about. So it's really critical. Of course, as you get in deeper and deeper water, it becomes less of an issue. But certainly on the shelf there. So a lot of study has gone into looking at the strudel scour, the scour of the ice on the seafloor, and understanding that. But it is absolutely a critical element that you have to protect that BOP when it's left there.
Renee called back from Beyond Esther, and I wanted to point out one other thing that you and I, you as the former director of oil and gas for the state of Alaska, are well aware of, and that is, the current law gives Alaska hardly any revenue from any kind of oil and gas activity beyond 3 miles. And he said, right. Maybe we're not getting anything. What? Maybe we should just say no.
Well, we get revenue sharing between 3 and 6 miles. But beyond 6 miles, and these wells are all significantly beyond 6 miles, we don't. And it is an issue. I know it's an issue. Our congressional delegation has taken on. Other states do get some coastal relief from that. However, we do, one thing it will do is, of course, is always the jobs issue, and also keeps taps operating for a lot longer. If you were to have significant production out there, certainly this issue of filling taps would no longer be an issue. The scale of the potential. You need a very large discovery to make it economic off there and to build the infrastructure necessary. to do it. So you would be looking at flows in the probably coming out of a discovery in the hundreds of thousands of barrels per day. Again, so if you're really worried about maintaining the existing infrastructure and throughput in taps, it is a pretty important issue. That said, that oil will, if it is successfully discovered and if development is approved, designed, built, environmentally permitted, then you're looking at least 10 years.
Yeah. We're talking with Mark Myers, Vice Chancellor for Research University of Alaska Fairbanks, by telephone on Talk of Alaska, and we're once again talking about Arctic offshore oil and gas drilling. It's fascinating once you get down into the nuts and bolts of this. If you were to set, let's say, three priorities, Mark, for research, for stuff that we need, that we should be looking at right now, what do you think they would be? I mean, so many things have been brought up about, you know, like safety culture, oceanography. It just seems that the technology, actually getting some real field experience with trying to with the ways that we might be able to handle this bill. What would be the top three that you would look at that we really need to start get going on?
There's sort of a time sequence in my mind. In the shortest term, it's really about the safety culture, as has been discussed by several callers, that we make sure that those multiple levels of safety are in place, and if they're not, that there's a requirement to do so. So maintaining a positive safety culture, maintaining any spill issue with a good capping device, et cetera, number one thing, lower the potential through multiple levels of safety, prevent the spill if you can, maintaining the ability to drill relief wells, et cetera. At the same time, the other big issue is the shipping issue. We have to have capacity to respond to an oil spill off a ship. The third is the development. The development piece of it means there's a lot of new research that we need to do within the next 10 years to develop ways to be able to manage this year-round potential production. And what if we have a problem with a subsea pipeline? That's when we have ice cover. So those sorts of things really involve, I think, technologically new approaches, better long-term observing systems. I think our ability to understand the ecosystem as it changes, the behavior of the ice and all those pieces of it is critical in all aspects. Investment, as Cheryl Rosa said in her opening mount, is not sufficient, and it's usually not sustained. So you have a big spill, a bunch of money will go into it, then it will drop off, and we'll have a period of quiescence where there's less research. And so that research component into the ecosystem, remote systems, capacity to observe, serve us in a number of ways. A caller mentioned the actual increase in wave energy, for example. Well, not only is that important to oil and gas industry, but it's important to coastal communities because it and the decrease in permafrost is causing rapid erosion of our coastline, potential to have to move villages, et cetera. That same sort of research plays in both areas. But fundamentally, then, the last piece I would say is forward basing of equipment. How do we do that? You know, we don't have a location for a deep water port north of Port Clarence, which is slightly north of Nome, where we can get maybe a 35-foot draft vessel in. There's no other shelter. So how are you going to actually do it? And then finally, investment in new icebreakers. We have to have a better icebreaking capacity in the country. We've got one operational medium-class iceberg in the Healy, and we have one of the polars that's getting retrofitted. That's two icebreakers for the United States for the entire Arctic, and that is very, very limiting to our capacity to respond in the marginal seasons.
Well, you know, St. Lawrence Island had some oiled wildlife just this past summer, and they went looking for the source, obviously, and they didn't ever find it. Now, St. Lawrence Island being where it is, there's wrecks and hulks, and it could have been something that came out of one of those. But, you know, there's a very real possibility. I'm thinking that it actually just came from the other side in some way that nobody tracked.
You know, I'm not sure that we have typed the oil. That's the first thing you would do to find out what type of oil. Is it processed or is it raw oil? You know, is it bunker fuel? Is it diesel? So it's real important to be able to type it.
It was a heavy bunker type of material, so it could easily have been fuel.
Probably out of a ship. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but anyway, it just brings that up because you brought it up twice now. You said, look, their shipping is going to be increasing. We have to have spill responsiveness regardless. We have to be prepared. So obviously it's a good point. Well, I want to go to a few of these email comments here. Pam Flowers said, all I can say is you take a glass of water, put one or two ice cubes in the water, put a drop of oil in that ice water, and you try and clean it up. You'd be hard-pressed to clean up that one drop, let alone all the oil from a spill. BP now admits to lying to us about how much oil was spilled in the Gulf, and I believe Shell would lie to us if there was a spill in the Arctic. We've literally gone to the ends of the earth in our pursuit of oil. It's time to put our resources into seriously developing alternative sources of energy. And, you know, it's hard to disagree. We do want to do that. Mark says, hey, I tuned in late here, but several oil field folks I know say there's no way this offshore oil would go into taps. You know, I wondered about that as well. I'll ask Mark what you think in a second here, but I want to get this one in from Ken. It seems to me that the most important first step is to recognize that in the case of a major event, a cleanup is impossible. Rapid containment is unlikely, so it too should be considered impossible. We should acknowledge the futility of response. Then we can move to regulation that will prevent the need for a response. Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, we just got a minute. But, yes, this business of, well, maybe there wouldn't be a pipeline. Maybe they just, maybe that's not what they're really looking for. What do you think?
Well, right now, as far as I know, Shell's design plan is for a pipeline.
It is, yes.
Array to connect the tap. So that's the working assumption. If you were to not use a pipeline, that means you have to ship it out, which means you have to have some storage and aggregation facility, and you would only have seasonal production unless you build major ice strengthened ships. Because you got to remember, the area freezes over. We will not, even with the melting of sea ice and the lengthening of the season, it's still going to be cold enough that we'll get single-year ice up there. So your only way to get it out then would have to be through you'd have to have some structure for offloading a terminal, again, really, and you're really shallow water, so you'd have to have it offshore. It would have to be strengthened enough and in water depths enough to be able to get tankers, and your tankers would have to be incredibly ice supported. And even then, I think there's seasonal little parts where you wouldn't be able to move it. So you
take them at their word. They're thinking there's enough there to support investing in a pipeline.
I think until we reach the point where we're ice-free for most of the year, I mean, if we made the climate shift, and I can't imagine that scenario, you either have to spend a lot of money on ice strengthened tanker capacity.
Okay, that's it. We got to go. Sorry, Mark Myers, thank you very much.
Alaska,
I'm Steve Heimel.
Made possible
Bye.
By this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.